Hey, everybody, it's Scott. Welcome back to Verbal Shenanigans. We are happy to bring you your annual Halloween treat, your spectacular, that is, the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. We've got two great episodes for you this week to celebrate the Halloween festivities. Now, we are brought to you by Manskirt Brewing. Manskirt Brewing is located in Hackettstown, New Jersey, located in the old bank building there on Main Street. And it's just a great place to go grab a beer. Go grab a nice craft beer, a seasonally inspired pint. Always something different. Now, they got St. James Men of Charity Microbrew Night on the 3rd, then Cheers in Morristown on the 10th, and NJ Tap Takeover at Hops in Morristown on the 14th. So a lot of events to go check out Manskirt and sample their product. Make sure to follow Manskirt on Instagram and Facebook and see all their happenings. And make sure you go there and have a beer. Manskirt Brewing. Now, we're also brought to you by Wolf Nation, WULF, Wake Up, Live Free Apparel. Now, Wolf Nation is an up-and-coming clothing company that's really designing some really nice stuff. And it's only a dream if you don't pursue it. That is Wolf Nation's motto. And make sure you go to wolfnation.rocks to check out their pre-orders, hats, snapbacks, pants, yoga pants. They're making it all, and you can buy it for your men, women, children in your life. So go check out Wolf Nation. Wake up, live free. Now, finally, we are brought to you by Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Trivia Revolution is in beer bars and breweries all over the state of New Jersey. And they're just a great company to work for and a great company to also go and have a good night out. You could be the dumbest guy in your group and still win prizes to bars and breweries all across New Jersey. Now, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. But welcome to episode 2 of the Halloween Spectacular. We are joined by two fantastic guests today. One of them is Father Sebastian, a vampire himself. And we have Alex Vincent from the movie Child's Play. So it is two Halloween-centric guests, and I hope you enjoy them both. And most of all, I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Greetings, this is Father Sebastian, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
Hey, this is Alex Vincent from the Chucky franchise. You're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, your shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
All right. Hello, everybody. So somehow one episode of Halloween greatness has been stretched into two, because this is 2 years in a row, Berlo. 2 years in a row, two Halloween episodes. Most podcasts hit you with one. We hit you with two long, boring episodes.
Yeah, Scott, I'm thinking next year, 12 Halloween episodes. Just nonsense. Just keep going. Like, we start in August and be like, screw you. We're talking about Candyman right now.
The 12 nights of Halloween. But anyway, so if you tuned in last week, we had quite a fun game show, or to part one, however we decided to put these up. Part one, we had a great game show where Mike and fellow comedian Mike Ciccoli were sentenced to hell, and they had to get through seven layers of hell to get back. And unfortunately, guys, Mike Berlo is still here.
I'm still here. The world loves me.
See what I deal with, people? You see what I deal with? 200
Trick or treat, Scotty.
220 episodes straight of this garbage.
Well, I had one good episode around 143. You know, I figured that'd be good enough.
That was your peak. That was when you plateaued.
I brought it all in 143. I'm like, you know what? That's a career. Going out in style.
Well, anyway, Berlo, you promised me, and guys, you're tuning into Verbal Shenanigans if this is your first listen. Simply a show, radio-style show, that we bring in guests, we play games, we talk about current events, we talk about our lives, and it's a little bit of a variety show, if you will. But we've had lots of great guests, so go check out our catalog if you're interested. But, Berlo, you promised me some help bringing me into the Halloween spirit, getting me going, feeling spooky, feeling good. You know, honestly, I was into it. I thought you were going to stay in hell and I was going to be a solo show. And then you came back and kind of drove me right back down. So what do you got for me?
Well, I mean, I think I know why you're down, Scott. I've been looking this up. I think the reason why you're so depressed is these new laws that they come out and all, specifically around the Halloween time. Am I getting close in why you're so discouraged?
You know, the man does hold us down. Every day there's a new law or something that's really taking the fun out of living.
Yeah, I mean, let's go through a few of them and all. I mean, I'm sure our guest knows about some of the crazy laws, but it gives them an idea of why you're so down.
Okay.
In, like, for example, masks. In Dublin, Georgia, you can't go out in public wearing a mask if you're under the age of 16. There are laws in New York prohibiting wearing of the mask since the 1800s. And in Walnut Creek, California, no one can wear a mask in public without the permit from the sheriff.
Wow.
Scott, are you depressed because you were going out to L.A. to do a big gig and you didn't get your permit yet?
Well, yeah. I tried to get a big acting gig, but I was, you know, I decided to wear a much handsomer man mask, and they made me take it off.
I mean, Scott, I told you. I mean, the proper paperwork needed to wear, you know, the mask of that girl from Frozen. I mean, that was killer when we went out to Walnut Creek, California. Or is it true that you were thinking about going to France?
Is that true? Oh, yeah.
I've always thought about what's going on. Scott, it's because you wanted to be a clown. And everybody knows years back, there were some problems with clowns in Vendergast, France.
Yes.
Now it's illegal on Halloween to wear clown costumes or makeup if you're more than 12 years old.
You know, that's not fair because my aunt was a clown when I was younger. And, you know, when I was feel like I was just carrying on the family a family business, if you will. Like, what's going to happen when she goes and there's no clowns left to pass it down?
Yeah, well, we know, Scott, that, you know, the town banned clown costumes on Halloween and for the entire month of November for anyone 13 and older. I know you were planning that France trip in November to dedicate to your aunt.
My aunt
specifically November.
My aunt clown dedication tour in France.
Yeah, and I know you were saying maybe I'll do it in January, but no, it was your goal to do it in November. Those wishes to dress up as clowns for fairs or other public festivals during the ban were required to get permission from the authorities. Yet again, the man needs to know when you dress up as a clown.
They need to step out, man. They need to just step out.
Well, the law was passed to avoid any disruptions by evil clowns, a representation. from the mayor's office told the press. I mean, a wave of panic sparked by pranksters dressed up as evil clowns and terrorizing passersby had spread across France for weeks. And the phenomenon in France had even prompted anti-clown vigilantism, forcing the police to step in to try and quell growing hysteria. Fake clown chased a man down the street and beat him with an iron bar, prompting a court to jail him for 4 months.
Wow.
Was that your brother that did that? Is that why you're so upset? He did the dedication first, and then
all these guys getting all hyped up and being like, let's go beat some clowns, you know? let's go find one of them and beat them.
They got the torches and the pitchforks. Send us the clowns. Send us the clowns.
And I picture, like, every time you hit the clown, you just hear, like, squeaks, like, you know, like as you're beating them.
Now, maybe, Scott, is it the age restriction that's suppressing you? There's a lot of states that are doing that now.
Age restriction for Halloween?
Yes.
Or to be a clown?
For dressing up. Like Belleville, Illinois has a host of regulations on trick-or-treating, including a ban on masks for anyone over 12 years old, limiting trick-or-treating to children in the 8th grade and under.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, and a trick-or-treating curfew, 5 to 8:30 p.m.
What was the oldest you got to with trick-or-treating?
I think around 13, somewhere in that range. Yeah. I remember one year I was like 15. I just was walking outside. I had no costume on.
Just going to ask you if you were one of those guys who just showed up and was like, give me, you know, just wearing a hoodie.
We weren't even like serious about it. Like, we would just be walking around. Like, we'd be somebody running to the, going to the car to like go to the store. We'd just yell trick or treat and laugh as they'd have to jump out of the car and run into the house to get us candy. But yeah. Did you know Belleville, Illinois actually had to come up with a legal definition for trick-or-treating?
You don't say.
Yeah, it's Halloween solicitation shall mean seeking or obtaining gifts, foods, candy, or contributions of money, and is customarily and commonly known as trick-or-treat in the celebration of Halloween Day. You know you're dealing with lawyers when they call it Halloween Day.
On the day of Halloween.
Halloween.
Not the eve of Halloween, nor the night, the day.
As a side note, Belleville, Illinois is also known for one of our disgusting little thing. They are the originators for the recipe for candy corn, apparently.
Oh, those bastards. I saw online there was a candy corn pizza.
Oh, yeah, that's a little too far. And going with the age thing, there's also restrictions in Newport, Virginia, where if you are seen trick-or-treating after 8 p.m., breaking rules would be a Class 4 misdemeanor punishable by a fine of up to $250.
$250?
Yeah.
That's a lot of candy you can buy.
Mm, exactly. Now, Scott, you're pretty religious. Were you planning to go out as like a religious figure?
Well, yeah, I was going as a sexy pope.
Yeah, well, I know your plan, Scott. You were going to come down to see me and go trick-or-treating in Alabama. But as you know, Scott, you can't dress like a priest in the state of Alabama on Halloween or any other day.
Oh, because the normal guys dressed as priests have never tricked any young children.
Yeah, we should be worrying about some other people. But according to the Alabama law, you may be arrested or fined if you dress up as a minister of any religion or nun, priest, rabbi, or other members of the clergy. If found guilty of violating this misdemeanor, you could be fined up to $500 or sentenced to a year in jail or both.
Wow. A year in jail for dressing like a sexy priest. It's not worth it.
Yeah. Now, you also know about the other law in Alabama, right?
Naturally. Apparently, so why don't you tell them, though?
You can't wear a mustache when you're attending church on Halloween in Alabama, as it may make people laugh if it is amusing. The law prohibits fake facial hair. Make sure you avoid wearing a mustachioed costume to church in Halloween.
Oh, so you could wear a real mustache.
Well, I mean, it's got to be pretty good. Like, if you got that paper-thin one, they might have to, you know, they might have to get a ruling or something.
Any thoughts of growing your mustache back that you grew out for one week?
The 1 week. Yeah. No, that was pretty pencil and pretty molesty.
It was pretty terrible. It was pretty terrible. If you combine that and that, what did you call the glasses you had? Like the B squad?
The third stringers, I called it.
Third stringers, yes, yes.
Yeah.
The Jeffrey
Dahmer.
It was
contacts, glasses. My regular glasses, and then the third stringers. But Scotty, you don't have to worry about Halloween when you go to Rehoboth Beach this year.
Ah, go visit Dogfish.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to worry because they only not allow Halloween's on Sundays.
On Sundays?
Yes, in Rehoboth, Delaware, you can't celebrate Halloween on the Halloween day if October 31st falls on Sunday. Trick-or-treating must take place on October 30th between 6 and 8 p.m. You may be fined up to $150. Kids younger than 14 have only 2 hours from 6 to 8 on Halloween to go door-to-door and ask for treats.
That just sucks, if you didn't know that law and you're, like, going house to house and everybody's, like, you're not getting any answers. You're like, God, this town sucks. Like, everyone's...
Be honest, you're just knocking on Dogfish's door and they'll give it there.
Drop me a 120 minute.
The law was last amended in 1977. But I mean, there's more than just trick or treating. I know you're getting upset because silly string is outlawed in Hollywood, California.
I love silly string.
Yeah, the use, sale, possession, or distribution of silly string is prohibited in Hollywood, California from 12 a.m. on October 31st until 12 p.m. on November 1st. Mm. you may be fined $1,000 for just holding the can.
Wow.
According to the ordinance, Silly String and the can it comes in is a hazard to pedestrians and to police on horseback or motorcycles because it causes them to slip and fall, Scotty.
Honestly, I don't like Silly String. I lied. Silly String gets everywhere when you play with it. It's like gets in your hair and it gets like, I don't know. I remember like I had I forget what it was, but I remember like it like stained my shirt like with like a Silly String oil. Not really into
it. Yeah. I don't think they really mastered the technology of Silly String to not stain.
Yeah, they can make an electric car, but not stainless Silly String.
Yeah, yeah. Come on, Elon Musk, get real.
Burlew snake milk and stainless Silly String.
We're cornering the market on everything I figure out.
We meet people's needs, and people need delicious, nutritious snake milk and stainless Silly String and spicy wine.
No, Michael Burlew Incorporated does not operate on October 31st nor November 1st in the city of Hollywood, California.
Stainless Silly String.
And finally, Scott, I know you love traveling.
Love it.
And you always wanted to go to the country of Jordan.
To the river of Jordan.
Yeah, and as we both know, the country of Jordan has made Halloween and its celebration illegal. You can't celebrate or attend Halloween celebrations. The U.S. Embassy advised U.S. citizens to expect police reaction, including arrests, at any public Halloween-themed event. The U.S. Embassy advised that U.S. citizens traveling from their home to a Halloween party or vice versa cover up their costumes while in public or in a car.
No, well, you know what? Like, I think if I was traveling to Jordan, the last thing I would be thinking about is, why don't we go down to Jordan for Halloween? See what kind of... See what celebration they got going on down there.
Can you imagine the first American that got arrested for that? Is it, what? I thought it'd be cool, man. What? This isn't Saudi Arabia? What?
Yeah. I guess if I was to travel anywhere for Halloween celebration, I'd probably try to go down to New Orleans. I think that would be probably pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. They probably mastered that down there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I know we've gone over this. I mean, is it comforting as we went over all your fears that you realize it's not a big deal and you can enjoy the Halloween spirit?
You know, like, I'm getting into it. I think I need a guest. Before we get to this guest, I was just texted to ask you something. I was asked to ask you about the beautiful the beautiful rose and the Burl's sampler.
Yeah. Now, so that's a little game I have with Isabel.
Now, the natural reporter I am, I'm going to have to dig deep and find out what this is. But let's get down to it. What the hell is going on here? What is this?
Well, one day I'm just joking around with Izzy about stuff, and you know, this is like pre-marriage, and she's talking about, oh, you're so lucky to have me, whatever. And just like on an ad lib, I'm like, well, you're lucky to have me because, you know, I'm a beautiful rose. And it was just one of those ad libbing things that I just stuck with it. And just when I get chances, I just kind of fit that in where I just tell her, you know, hey, you shouldn't be talking to me like that. You don't want to wilt a beautiful rose.
Ah, yes. Stuff like that. Have a petal fall off this beautiful rose.
Yeah. As for the other one,
something tells me this is the one that you're like, oh, crap. Because I saw you smile when I said the Burl sampler.
Well, the Burl sampler was, I was just downstairs with her. We're watching one of her shows on I think Netflix or Amazon, I forget the name of it. It's a new show with like Tony Shalhoub about the female comedian in like the 50s or whatever. But she was watching it and commenting on like one of the people, and they're like, oh, you're just a side piece. And I'm, you know, being cute. And, oh, I'm just a side piece to you. She's like, no, you're my appetizer. You're my, dinner, you're my dessert. I'm like, oh, so I'm your Burl sampler that you ordered, huh? And that's how the two come into fruition. So
you just like refer to yourself as the sampler.
The Burroughs sampler. I mean, in that scenario, I generally call myself the beautiful rose tour just to annoy her. But the Burroughs sampler just happened tonight. So Verbal Shenanigans exclusive.
That's just in. Mike did another weird thing.
I just see some guy running into your office with a piece of paper. Mr. Brennan, oh, hot off the presses.
We're getting news. This just in from Georgia. This is in for Georgia. And it seems that Mike Burlew has done something weird again. We're getting news out of the system that the Burroughs sampler is hot and off the press. Ladies.
It is hot, the Burroughs sampler.
Don't get all hotsy-totsy, but the Burroughs sampler is on the market. We hear he's really the bee's knees.
Don't be stealing Aaron McGuire's jokes now. Come on now.
I don't know why I just went into like 1940s radio announcer, but it's the first thing I can think of.
There's nothing that's sketched on this show, so it's all on the whim. It's bound to happen.
Always, always. Anyway, I guess it's time for a guest, Mike.
Yes, I agree with that, Scott.
Well, I can only tell you about the Burroughs sampler. Not only is it ridiculous that you call yourself the Burroughs, now you call yourself many like different names that spring
adaptations
off
the of the Burroughs.
The Burroughs sampler. All right, you big you big rose, why don't you introduce this guest?
Beautiful rose, how dare you. Coming on to our show is Father Sebastian. He is an author and a personaro, a fangsmith, and a central personality of the modern vampire subculture, and he's going to be talking with us about all that stuff. But I tried to get you to a vampire bar for the Shenanigans Showdown. I was hoping for that.
Well, you know, like there's still time. You know, it might not happen for that showdown, but you know, maybe this interview goes well, and we'll fly you up, and we'll just buddy up and eat people together.
Yes, yeah. I'll just walk into the bar. Did somebody order a beautiful rose?
So Sebastian, first off, thanks for giving us a few minutes on the show here. We appreciate the time for sure. So thanks.
No problem.
Now, my first question is like, you know, we're doing this interview around 9:30 Eastern time. Is this like just the start of like your night, or is this like the end? Like, are you just getting ramped up? Because I feel like in like a vampire culture, this has to be early.
That's a big misconception.
Really?
I mean, we like the night because there's more people dreaming and it's quieter and there's no sun, which gives me headaches, but I usually go to bed around 9:30, 10 o'clock at night and wake up at 7 and get a good night's sleep and work out with a bunch of witches.
Interesting. So let's go to the bare bones here. What exactly is a vampire, if you will? Is it like a religious thing? Is it a lifestyle? Is it role playing? What brings people into this world, if you will?
Well, you answered the question. It's all of those things and some of them and many more. I think that one of the things that you need to realize is the vampire is a very empowering archetype in our subculture and or in our culture. And there's many interpretations that are related to the vampire. The modern vampire came with by Polidori was a story written in, I believe, 1821 or 1819. And it was written as a ghost story with Mary Shelley. And she wrote another story called Frankenstein. And that was the original vampire story about a vampire named Lord Ruthven. And then throughout the 19th century, you had penny dreadfuls and the vampire lore of the Victorian era kind of capsulated into the greatest vampire in history, Dracula himself. which was a symbolic of the Slavic plague coming in, the Slavic people as a plague coming into London culture. So it was a very racist book between different European tribes. And what happened was, is Dracula was the largest influence on the vampire world. I call the vampire world everything that has to do with vampires, from role-playing to lifestyle to mythology to legends, lore. The vampire world is its own thing. In fact, I'm preparing to work on a documentary called Vampire World. And we're going to go into all the, we're going to go to the locations and investigate six of the greatest vampire myths.
Nice.
Very cool.
So we're going to film that in 2020, 2019. We're not sure exactly when we're going to start production on that.
So now, when did you get drawn into this culture, and what made you fascinated with it?
My mom. My mom and I always watched horror movies when I was a kid. And one of the things that I kept dreaming of was vampiric-like entities that would float above my bed and invade my dreams. And I did some research, and there was a really good book series from the late 80s that influenced a lot of people in the Gen X generation called Mysteries of the Unknown, I believe. And it was by Time Life Books. And it was this whole series of ghosts and vampires and goblins.
Like
and
series of scary stories, that one?
No, it was actually like UFOs. It was all different weird paranormal stuff. So I've been in the paranormal world for quite a long time, and one of the things that I've always enjoyed was the darkness, the witchcraft, and the mystery. And you know, I've been in the UFOs and ghost hunting and spirits and magic and all of this paranormal activity, and has always drawn me to it. But I've never really fully embraced the evil or the good. A lot of my friends call me. A particular friend calls me neutral. And so the evil spirits don't bother me, and the good spirits kind of like make deals with me.
So, and you were speaking about your mother before. Like, I was reading up, like, you, your grandfather was worked in dentistry, and you kind of worked off of that, and you became a fangsmith, and you. The first person you ever actually gave fangs to was your mother, which is interesting. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, how much work or detail goes into, you know, adding the extra length to the people's tooth, and maybe some stuff we don't understand how hard it can be to do something like that surgically.
Well, it's not a surgical procedure. It's a cosmetic procedure. So... to get permanent fangs, I have an associate dentist here in Beverly Hills who, 90210, takes the fang that I make and casts it in what we call zirconia and puts it in permanently, installs it as a cap with a special adhesive and puts it on. It doesn't damage the teeth or anything, and it lasts about a year. There's another way to do it, but what I do as a fangsmith, as a dental technician, is I make acrylic caps that fit perfectly over the teeth. And I have two companies. I have the Sabretooth Company, which is me personally making fangs for my Sabretooth clients. And there's an entire private social network for them. And then I have a more commercial venture, which is just starting, called 3dfangs.com, which is you actually get a vinyl impression of your mouth. Through what we call an impressionist, or send a dental impression in. We scan that, and then we make the fangs according to the design that you want. We have eight different styles, and you'll be able to wear them, and they're just as nice as the caps that I make now. But if you lose them or break them, all you do is you go on the website and order a new pair once you get your membership.
Oh, it's fascinating. Now, looking over the bio of you, the interesting thing I saw about the fangs is it said good for singing. So I'm kind of curious to know who tested that out.
Fernando from the band Moonspell. Lady V from the band Theater of the Vampires. And Mike Hideous, who was the lead singer of the Misfits for 2 years. All sang with my fangs on stage. A lot of musicians and artists will sing. I have an opera singer that's a part of my vampire court, The Endless Night. and she sings opera with her fangs on.
Wow.
So when did that start, though? When did that start? Like, you were you just like, you know, when did that next step come? Like, where you were into vampire culture and, like, paranormal culture? When did you decide to, like, really adapt that life and get into not only having the fangs, but also being able to make them for people?
Well, the fang making kind of got me into the vampire culture at the same time I got into it. It was in 1993 when I got my first pair of fangs. I got it with my girlfriend named Dawn, and Dawn was a really lovely girl, and Dawn has since passed away. She had a brain tumor most of our relationship, and Dawn wanted to go to a prom, so I felt that it was cool to take Dawn to the prom. She missed her prom the year before because she was ill. But Dawn was she was a very gangrel wolf-like creature, you know, very gypsy-esque, long black hair, and, you know, kind of like, you can see her hanging out with Esmeralda in front of Notre Dame. Very, very classy, very lovely girl. She was from Princeton, New Jersey, and we wanted to go to she missed her prom because she was sick the year before. And so I invited her. And she goes to me, she's like, I love vampires. I want to get fangs. And I'm like, well, I happen to be in the vampire culture and know a fangsmith named Gregor. So she and I went on the 8th of November 1993, and we got our fangs in preparation for our prom. And we got all dressed up for the prom, and we went to the prom as vampires. And we had perfectly, like, awesome fangs. Gregor made great fangs for us. And then he retired, and a lot of people were asking me to make fangs for them. Because I was working in a retail outlet, and I was working at a nightclub called The Limelight, running Vampire the Masquerade role-playing games. And if you've ever seen the movie Party Monster, that's where I started my business, right in that nightclub with Michael Alec and that whole crowd being part of the cast. So I worked in Limelight, and I went out there and I looked for a vampire culture in New York. I was like, where is everybody besides role-playing games? And there was a couple there was like four or five vampires that lived in New York, but they didn't really interact. So I said, you know what? I'm going to start a vampire subculture, and I'm going to throw a vampire ball. And so I started making fangs and throwing parties for people to wear the fangs through.
Oh, interesting. So when you started, when it first started with the Vampire Ball in New York City, and eventually you make Endless Nights in New Orleans, tell us about the original days. Did everybody who come get kind of an idea of what the vision of the vampire culture is, or did some people have to explain? People who show up there who don't even know what it's about and want to learn about it?
Well, there wasn't much to learn because the only things that we had were Anne Rice, the Temple of the Vampire, which was a vampire church, which is a vampire church, and another group called the Vampire the Masquerade Role Players. So you had your role players, religious vampires, then you had your blood drinkers, you had your psychic vampires, and you had your lifestyles. Everything wasn't as defined as it is today. And so it was a really exciting time because people were kind of like the subculture itself was finding its identity.
So now give the common man, if you will, me. give us a little insight into, like, you know, we see the movies, we have our own predispositions. We think that we hear the blood drinking thing, and that's what we see. What is that, one? And two, is that still part of the culture today? And how do they make that happen?
What, blood drinking?
Yes.
Well, I think that there's a bunch of different interpretations. For me, it's simply a fetish, like, you know, any other kink. You know, if you're into being a pony or
right.
And then being a, you know, dressed up like a, you know, transgender or mm-hmm. whatever. I think it's called sanguinarian or sanguine. And it's a tradition of vampirism that it's one of the tribes.
Okay.
As I call them. There's different tribes of vampires. There's the Sang vampires, which are blood drinkers. Then there's different sub-tribes of that. Like, there's the Med Sangs that don't identify with the vampire archetype, but they believe they need to drink blood. So the only place they can find to be able to talk about this is the vampire subculture. But they come into the vampire subculture,
And then they call us all fake because we don't have a medical condition to drink blood. And I'm like, guys, you don't have porphyria, which is like the like actual vampire disease where it makes you crave iron. So you know, your gums recede, you look pale, it's hard to go out in the sunlight, and you crave blood. So that's called porphyria. And there's only 20 people in the United States that have that. And these people don't have porphyria. Okay, they're not diagnosed with it. And you don't want porphyria. Porphyria sucks. It's like, you know, a lot of people think Vlad Tepes had it. So I don't think that's an accurate truth, but that's the sanguine vampires. There's people that believe that the only way to get life force is through blood. Then there's medsangs, which think it's actually a scientific medical condition. We'll see what the, you know, there's no scientific or psychological evidence whatsoever that you have to drink blood more than a kink. Okay. And my experience, for me, it's a, you know, there's, you can, if you look at it at a metaphysical level, that's a whole different thing. However, it's extremely dangerous. It's very, very, very dangerous. And you're limited to one or two donors because, and then you got to build relationships with those people to get donors. So it's very high maintenance. So it's not practical to be a Fang vampire, in my opinion. Unless you're in a monogamous relationship and it's in your bedroom and you're doing it like both tested and taken care of. And, you know, that's my opinion. Now, there's psychic vampires who are energy vampires who feed off life force. And a lot of people believe that, you know, you can evolve into a psi vamp, okay, or you can, you know, psychic or whatever. But there's you take psychic vampires and divide them into two categories. There's old school psychic vampire definition and the new school psychic vampire definition. And then you can go into a whole bunch of variety of like psychic self-defense against psychic vampires. And in my clan, we take energy very honorably. We don't ever steal it. Like, we have a very strict code on how to take energy, and we have enough to be able to do what we need to do. And then there's the lifestylers, who it's very much a philosophy and an aesthetic, a fashion aesthetic. So you can be a Psy Sang and a lifestyler, or you can be a Sang and a lifestyler, or you can be a Psy and a lifestyler. But most people try to like learn how to take energy. And a lot of the sanguinarians and psychic vampires have a debate, and they constantly go back and forth. And I just think it's taking energy is taking energy, whether it be a blood or whatever technique you do it, but just do it safely and honorably. And don't do it in a unethical way, because, you know, it's, you're all stardust. You know, the energy that makes you up came from somewhere else, and you get to borrow it for the time you're born to the time you die. And then afterwards it goes off into the universe into something else. I'm sure the matter that exists in your body today in 100 million years will be in another sun or a planet or an animal or something. It's just the transfer of energy is very much interesting to think about. Hmm. So
fascinating.
Those are the, and then the role players are people that really enjoy playing Vampire the Masquerade, which is an incredible mythology. So if you look at the mythology, are you there?
Yep, we're here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. If you look at the mythology, the three greatest influences on the vampire mythology in the vampire world are Bram Stoker's Dracula,
right?
Anne Rice in Interview with the Vampire, and Vampire the Masquerade, the role-playing game, which really most of the modern interpretation of vampire mythology is based on, like the clans of vampires. In fact, True Blood, Blade, and Underworld, the movies and TV shows, are basically ripoffs of the Vampire the Masquerade's interpretation of vampire.
Interesting. So, as I read up on you, it talks about how you wrote the Black Veil's, the Code of Conduct. I'm kind of curious, was this like a writing just as like a general guideline, as a law? What came about by making these?
Well, the Black Veils are much more than a code of conduct. They're a set of traditions, they're a philosophy, they're a culture, and they all started in the 1990s at a club called Long Black Veil, which was a vampire lounge in the meatpacking district of the village, or the west side, 14th Street in Washington. It was the Thursday night of a nightclub called Mother, which was all about you know, they had a transgender night. They had a, and we were their kind of gothic vampire night. They had different theme nights throughout the week. And the owner was very vampire friendly and loved the vampire subculture. And after I went to the Anne Rice Ball in New Orleans, I decided in 1995, which was the biggest vampire ball in history, it was 6,000 people.
Wow.
I wanted to open, I was working at Limelight and I wanted to do a vampire ball. I mean, what better place to do a vampire ball? And the owner of the club came to me and said, I would like to open a vampire club. And a lot of the vampire, I wanted to create something that was for all the vampire tribes, not just role players or lifestylers, but people could go. And it was a Victorian vampire, Venetian, Versailles themed event. And we had a coffin and everybody was wearing long black veils and there was rituals. And one, and a couple of the rules that we started, we called, nicknamed the Black Veils, which were the code of conduct of the nightclub. That evolved into over 600 different veils.
Huh.
Each one is a page. And some veils are interlinked with each other. And
so can,
like,
you,
there's,
can you give us an idea, like, what is some of the code of conduct? Like, what, like, you guys, what is everybody
following?
Well,
originally, code of conduct was you have to wear all black to the club, no photography in the club, no blood drinking allowed on the premises. You know, you can bring your food home. It's a takeout menu only. 18 to enter, 21 to feed. What else? Be ladies and gentlemen at all times. This is Victorian, and Victorian etiquette is the thing. So people would be on the dance floor, like holding a lady's hand and opening doors, and all this old etiquette was just very primal for the vampire culture. And plus, we had a BDSM room down in the basement where you can do shibari and get spanked and tied up and stuff.
Interesting. But, so, let me ask, when as you've gone along throughout the years, how much have you seen more, and how much have you seen, like, change going to different places? Is there a certain place where we might be surprised how big a, like, a vampire culture is?
Well, I think it's bigger than it is. It's more socially acceptable now. I think in the 1990s, it was very underground. It was basically centered in New York and Los Angeles and London. And there was, like, scattered groups in Germany throughout the Gothic scene. But we had a lot of, and Seattle had a lot because the Temple of the Vampires from Seattle. So New Orleans was the obvious middle ground. But you'd be surprised, like, Tampa, Florida was, like, a huge center of the vampire culture from about 1997 to 2010. It's kind of subsided since then in Tampa.
No, let me ask you, like, so obviously, like, this is we talk about a subculture or something that goes on in, you know, you have your groups and whatnot. How do you or people who have to deal with going to, like, quote unquote, the normal workplace and whatnot, or how to fit into this? Do most people hide this, or are most people very open about it? Because you obviously are very open about it, which is why, obviously, why we have you on the show. But what about people who are going through this who work their normal job? Do they have to, like, kind of hide that life?
Most people that you meet in the vampire culture are not gothic.
Okay.
Okay. They might wear all black,
right,
but that doesn't mean they're goth. So goth is a social subculture based on a common music. Okay. And aesthetic. Well, vampire subculture is basically embracing the archetype of the vampire. And most people that are vampires are, they kind of are just drawn to the archetype. And, like, I mean, you have vampires that own schools and are teachers, and you have people that are university professors that are identified as vampires. But most vampires, you know, I get a lot of people that send me messages from the Midwest that they're like, you know, they're a vampire and they're stuck in the Midwest. And I'm like, it's none of anybody's business what you are. Okay, it's you know, because you if you want to go off and express yourself with the aesthetic and the costumes and call attention to you, you're going to call attention to your prey. Okay, you know, you're taking life force from humans, and, you know, why would you go and tell them, all right, you know, hey, you know, I'm taking a life force, unless you want to do it consensually. And one of the things that I find really interesting is that the people who are posers complain most about not being able to express themselves. People who really embrace the empowering elements of the vampire mythology, for example, what's in the Black Veils, are about empowerment, should be, you know, not giving a shit. Like, I mean, I know three pastors that are vampires, and they practice Christianity and they preach Christianity. I know a Catholic priest who's a vampire, and he's a practicing vampire. I mean, but it's none of anybody's business what his sexuality is, and it's his private business that he's a vampire. And, you know, he doesn't have to go off. I know quite a few people who are religious leaders, especially in Christianity. I mean, vampirism is not a religion. It's a philosophy and a lifestyle and an energy condition. So the majority of the vampire community doesn't think it's a religion. Most, about 95% of the vampire community doesn't consider it a religion.
Interesting. So how do you feel, like, if you talk to somebody, say you're a vampire, and they go through throwing out, like, movies of today and all, like, saying a joke, oh, Blade or Nosferatu or something like that. When stuff like that comes out, is that frowned upon in the vampire community, or is that just, like, almost adding to the legend of vampires?
It's amplifying the vampire world. It's raising it up. I mean, there's so many amazing vampire movies out there. I would say the top three are Interview with the Vampire, Bram Stoker's Dracula, and Lost Boys. And then you
Lost
have
Boys. I forgot about that movie.
Yeah. And then you, of course, have, you know, movies like What We Do in the Shadows, which is a comedy, which is awesome. We have all sorts of different amazing subcultures and groups and movies. Just really, there's so many movies where the vampires are the main characters.
Yeah.
And Interview with the Vampire, Queen of the Damned, Lost Boys, what else? Near Dark. One of my favorite recent ones was Only Lovers Left Alive. The Hunger, Blade was like a huge influence on the vampire subculture. But Blade mostly is a reinterpretation of the comic book character Blade,
right?
And was based on Vampire the Masquerade. If you know the story of Vampire the Masquerade and look at Blade, there's so many, a lot of the things that Vampire the Masquerade brought into the vampire mythology, or the vampire mythos, as I call, which is the whole mythos.
Mm-hmm.
Vampire the Masquerade brought in the concept of clans and bloodlines and vampires having a religion in modern mythology.
Now, is there any movies that, like, do it a disservice to you? Like where you think it's, like, corny, or it's just, like, gives you a bad name?
I think Blackula. I don't know. I mean, Vampire in Brooklyn was a very good blaxploitation movie. Because Eddie Murphy was like, Vampire in Brooklyn was really a good movie, in my opinion. But a lot of people think it was a cheesy movie. And it was funny because there was a bunch of vampires living in Brooklyn. So when the movie came out, they were living in a house together. So we called it the Vampire House of Brooklyn in Canarsie.
Blackula. Love it.
So, what's on the horizon for you? You've done a few books. You talked about the movie you're coming out with. What's the latest on more clubs or events that are coming out that you're helping?
Well, we're hosting vampire salons all over Europe and a central vampire ball. I've just spent 14 years living in Europe, and I had a wonderful experience, but I really would like to be back in California where I was born. And I really love LA, and I think my real gist right now is helping the different vampire clans and groups and the vampire world succeed and grow. And we've established kind of a common agreement that that Los Angeles is going to be the vampire capital of the world for the next 10 years.
Really?
So, you know, first it was New York. Then it was Paris. Now it's going to be Los Angeles. And But there's two homelands, as I call it. The homelands are New Orleans and Romania.
Right. Now, let me ask you, how do you, before we go, how do you like, survive, like, financially at, like, embracing this culture? Have you found a way to work it as your normal life, or do you have to do other things, and then this is kind of like your passion?
Well, I'm a tour operator. I run walking tours around several cities.
Oh, okay. And,
but my real event, Endless Night, Vampire Ball, is my business. I provide services for the vampire community. A lot of people have gone to me, oh my God, you're just capitalizing. And I'm like laughing. And I'm like, I could make a lot more money doing something else. And what my personal passion, my father always told me to follow your passion. And my passion is vampires. I love the aesthetic. I love the archetype. I love people wearing fangs and smiling and looking in the mirror for the first time. And I love being an artist and creating events and bringing people around the world. And I like to be the father of the vampire world. You know, a lot of people think, I think of myself as an architect of this interpretation of the lifestyle vampire community. But I also have a passion for other people's successes with vampires. Like my friend, I'm very close, good friends with the people that are doing the new edition of Vampire the Masquerade, the role-playing game. And I'm really excited to see their success.
Right.
And I think that role-playing games are a really good way of interacting with fantasy and media and in mythology and having a good testing ground. And the new edition of Vampire the Masquerade just came out, and that was one of the greatest influences in my life.
Now, you touched on something I did want to ask you. What about, like, your family life? How did that happen? Like, and how did they deal with, or, like, are they very accepting of your choice and the way you live, or do they question it? Is it kind of funny? Like, do you guys like laugh about it, or like how what is your dynamic with your family?
I come from a very moderate family. My dad's really proud of me. I mean, he's, you know, my grandmother was kind of weirded out by it, but she saw my first vampire magazine when I was in high school. But my whole family, I mean, they're just like, oh, you're the black sheep, but let's go to Thanksgiving, you know? and one thing that a lot of our venues, the clubs that we work with, major venues like the House of Blues or four-star restaurants in Beverly Hills, have all said something, and some of the biggest club promoters in Europe have said that my audience, the Sabretooth Clan and the Endless, which are people that attend the Endless Night events, are some of the most cultured, educated, classy, respectful, best guests. We rent a castle in Austria every summer, and we have a conclave, which is a gathering of vampires, where we rent the castle for an entire week and do a vamp camp, where it's kind of like Hogwarts meets a vampire castle, and it's owned by the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Austria, which is a very conservative church, but they're very open-minded. And they said we're the best guests that they have all year. So, like, you know, we bring our cups back to the bar. We tip well. We dress well. We're well spoken. We spend money at establishments that we prevail. There's a big, big, big respect amongst the Sabretooth Clan that all came from the Black Veil Party. And the Sabretooths are my fan clients. And some, you know, making fangs doesn't turn you into a vampire, okay? But it helps the awakening for some people. And what is really making me laugh is that we have relationships with the Catholic Church. We have relationships with the Mormons. We have relationships. I mean, they don't sit there and think we're crazy. And it's because of the Sabretooth Clan being the leader of the vampire community. And we set the tone, we set the example, because we seek to have that higher frequency. And everybody, you meet one of my clients, you'll probably like be fascinated with them. They're wonderful people.
Awesome. Well, we really appreciate the time that you gave us today, Father Sebastian. If anybody wanted to get a hold of you and kind of find out some places to go and learn more about vampire culture, where can they go?
you should check out my personal website, fathersebastian.com. If you want to look at, find me on Instagram or Facebook, at Father Sebastian. If you want to know about the documentary project I'm working on, go to vampireworld.com. And for all my events, it's endlessnight.com, and there's a schedule of events, and maybe we'll be coming to a town near you.
Well, now, one other question before we go. We've been asking all of our guests this as of recently. I'm not sure what your feelings are about pizza, but we got to know, are you a fan or a foe of pineapple pizza?
I'm pretty good with pineapple pizza. I like the wine, so I got to get some pork on it.
Yes, Father. Mm. Yes, Father. I'm converted.
I've since given it up for I'm a New York pizza boy. All right. Okay, so there's New York pizza is far superior to Chicago pizza. So don't misinterpret my intentions there.
Nothing
against Chicago, but they're good for their hot dogs.
Yeah, my whole thing is that I'm like progressive. Mike's an old curmudgeon. He doesn't like people like you guys and your vampire culture or pineapple pizza. No.
Vampires and pineapple pizza go along together?
No, I'm just saying he likes traditional pizza.
I'm pro vampire. I'm con pineapple pizza. That's the key to this interview tonight.
He won't bend on it. But I always said the pineapple and ham, pineapple and bacon, pineapple and hot peppers, great combination on pizza.
Good idea. I like onions and pepperoni from New Jersey. I don't know why. There's this one pizza place in Jersey. You guys are from Jersy, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well,
I'm originally from Jersey. Yep. Yeah.
I grew up in Red Bank.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, nice. I was in Woodbridge, so I'm right up the park.
I used to go to Woodbridge Mall and buy books at the game shop.
Oh my God, the game shop is still open, by the way.
Are you kidding me? That was my like introduction to role playing games.
I swear to God, like back in the day when we played Magic the Gathering and I was starting to get some cards, like that was the place to go to get a couple. What do they call them? Starter packs or expansion packs? They're still open.
That's awesome. I remember all the pool tables there. My dad would go look at the pool tables, and I'd go look at the games.
Yeah, the pool tables. I always loved the chess boards. That always fascinated me. Like, it made me want to like get better at chess. Like, just to buy something that expensive, like one of those chess boards. I really wanted to get good at chess, but I never really got that good. But so Sebastian, I want to thank you for coming on, man. I'm glad that you like pineapple and pizza, and I'm glad that you're open to talking about breaking down the stereotypes that we a lot of people fear or misjudge and whatnot. So I think it's awesome that you gave us a couple minutes, and thank you.
My pleasure. Have a good time, and have a great Halloween, everyone.
Absolutely. All right, Berlu. As our, I don't even know what how many Halloween episodes we're in at this point, but
I guess technically our fourth.
Yeah, something like that. So we have a Halloween themed guest. Who we got?
Yeah, we got actor Alex Vincent, who is most famous for playing the little boy Andy Barkley in the horror movie franchise Child's Play. He's also a writer and the owner and producer at AV Production Recording Studios and Production Company in Clearwater, Florida.
Oh, he was Chucky. Got it.
Nope, he was Andy. Oh, Andy was the one Chucky was trying to get his soul into.
Oh, he looked great in that Chucky costume. I don't know how they did that, but he looked awesome.
Scott, I think you didn't read the notes for tonight.
You said he's the kid from Child's Play. The doll.
No, not the doll. The kid that the doll tried to kill or take over.
Well, agree to disagree. So let's give Alexander Vincent a call. Alex, first off, thanks so much for giving us a few minutes here. You're a fellow Jersey guy, correct?
I am, yeah. I grew up here. I lived up in Jersey for 27 years in North Jersey.
You sound so excited about that.
Well, I love Jersey. I'm up here now visiting, actually. I mean, I love every opportunity I have to come up here. I'm happy to have escaped the snow, which is why I moved to Florida 10 years ago. But, no, I love Jersey. I'm from North Jersey, which is – I'm from North Jersey, which, as anyone who lives here knows, is a completely different state than South Jersey.
That is 100% true. I guess I'm kind of in North Jersey, too. I'm in Denville, so, like, I'm Northwest Jersey, but definitely north of the Jersey Mason-Dixon line.
Yeah, I had experiences in both sides. I also had some time in Central, so I'm the more experienced Jerseyan, but I went to Georgia, so.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Al, thank you for giving some time with us right now. I mean,
sure.
I guess let's jump right into it. And all. I mean, how old were you when you landed the role for Child's Play?
I was 6 years old for the first film. I think might have been five when I auditioned for it. I know by the time I was out in L.A. filming it, I was six. We started in Chicago, actually, with part one. But yeah, I was six in the first film, and I was eight in the second, and I was 32 in the sixth and 35 in the seventh. So amazingly, you know, for 30 years, I've been playing the same character. It's bizarre, but very fortunate.
When you were going in, did you understand? I mean, what were you, just a little kid who's like, oh, I'd like to get into acting, or were your parents pushing you into acting? How did that go about?
Well, there was a girl who lived down the street from me who did commercials. When I was 5 years old, I saw her on TV. I think, if my memory is right, that she was doing one of those "This is your brain, this is your brain" on drugs commercials.
Nice.
And I knew her and I recognized her. You know, she was a neighbor. So that just gave me the idea that I wanted to be on TV. You know, I thought it was super cool. And was something that I wanted to do. So my parents went and followed up with her family on where, you know, how she got started. And we went out to her manager out in New York, and she, you know, worked with several different agents, and I just started going on auditions. And I did that for, you know, 8 years of my childhood. Child's Play was the biggest thing that I got, but I did several other things. And then when I was, you know, 13, I had been going to auditions three or four times a week after school for 8 years of my childhood, and it just wasn't really very fun anymore. So that, you know, it was my decision to start, and it was my decision to stop when I did.
Now, when your parents realize, like, so the script comes across for Child's Play, whatnot, and they realize what kind of movie it is, were they completely into it? Were they like weary about it, or were they like, we're gonna take whatever role we can get, this sounds cool? What was their reaction to that?
Yeah, my mother just didn't want Andy to die. That was her only real concern. So considering that turned into three decades worth of this franchise, I'm very happy she put her foot down about that also. You know, but and that was her only real concern. I was a very bright kid, and I often say I was smarter at six than I am now. I think that's partially intentional. But yeah, I was a bright kid. I knew I had the whole script memorized, all my lines, all everybody else's lines. I knew exactly what was happening and what they needed from me. I thought the puppeteering at work that was making the doll look the way it did, I thought was the coolest thing. You know, I wanted to be a puppeteer. I thought it was amazing how they made them work. So there was nothing scary about it. You know, the content of the film didn't translate to day to day, you know, filming. There's nothing scary about being on set. So it was cool.
Well, how tough of a day shooting? How long would they have you at the film doing your scenes? Because a lot of times we see with any kind of movie, they like to try to get twins in there so they can get double the time. But
there are a lot of child's labor laws at play. I think, you know, I can only work a 6-hour day, and I have to have 3 hours of tutoring for school every day. So yeah, I mean, it was lucky for me, really, because the doll took a lot of work and had, you know, 7 or 8 SAG puppeteers operating him. That, you know, the doll was a lot, it cost a lot of money for the studio to shoot. So they would try to get my stuff done and finished early in the day, to get past my hours. And then they'd finish the doll, and then the other actors would have to stay and shoot their shots late. You know, in the second film, Christina Lee did most of that stuff. Anytime it's just her on camera, it was just her on set. And I got to leave early, so it was good for me.
Now, what are you trained at all, like when they're going through this, how to act with a doll or puppet as opposed to acting with a person? Like, are they giving you pointers, like, or is it just like you're kind of talking to someone behind the doll?
Well, no, I was basically just reacting to the doll. Luckily, Brad Dourif's voice was always on set, so anytime the doll was talking to me, I was able to act off of Brad's voice still, which was helpful. But I had a really good acting coach that helped me with that and any of the issues that I had. You know, she was experienced working with children, and she was a great actress herself, and, you know, she was very, very helpful.
Now, when I was reading up on the movie, it seems like a lot of parents were, like, protesting the movie, talking about it was inciting violence with children. Did you hear anything about that? Did anybody talk to your parents about that?
No, that was above my age grade, I guess, if you will. I that's not something that they concerned me with. I remember hearing that the film was banned in England because some kid killed his friend because Chucky told him to, or something along those lines. So they banned the film in England for a while. And I'm not sure if that was the first or second or even third film that was banned over there, but I remember hearing that, but nothing more than that. It was not something that anyone ever told me about.
When you're doing these movies, you did the first two, and you're getting people recognizing you. Is it kind of cool going to, like, school, or were you always home tutored being such an actor? Or are you able to kind of, like, grow up saying, wow, this is pretty neat? Or are you free to yourself?
Well, where I grew up in a small town, it was the same kids, basically the same 80 kids from first grade to eighth grade. And I made the first film, you know, at the end of my first grade. And then third grade was the second film. So all those kids I knew from before I made the films, during and after. So they didn't really treat me much different, you know. Plus, in the late 80s, children weren't watching R-rated horror films as often as they are nowadays.
So
for the most part, it was fine then. I never really experienced much of anything. And when I went to high school, this was three or four towns that got together into high school. So I got a lot of, you know, not bullying by any means, but I mean, I was kind of hanging out with the kids that weren't one to be bullied anyway. But it was a lot of, like, you know, Chucky, let me get a cigarette kind of thing. But besides that, it was cool.
Now, you came from an era, like, these movies come from an era where puppetry was like, awesome and well done.
Yeah, sure.
And now, obviously, as technology moves forward, people, you know, a lot of things are CGI and you know, animated and whatnot. Are you, like, do you look at some of those horror movies and, like, not feel the same about them? Like, are you, like, you know, like, is it almost nostalgic to see movies that still go with, like, puppets and props and live things like that? And do you find the ones that are animated kind of don't have the same feeling as the early ones do?
No, you know, I'm not really too much of a stickler on that. I know how some people feel that way.
Right.
As anyone who's been in the film business, you get a little meticulous and dissect films when you watch them, and that's really a tribute of what is a good film, the ones that you can not think about every little detail of how it was made. But I think, no, as far as visual effects, however they get to a compelling image, is fine. I mean, I don't really, you know, have a loyalty to any particular practice of getting there. If CGI works for them and it doesn't look shitty, am I allowed to say that on your podcast?
You can say anything.
If it doesn't look fucking shitty,
whoa.
You know, then it's fine. But if something looks tacky, whether it's practical effects or CGI, if it's anything that pulls you out of the scene because you're thinking about the effect, then it's a failure. You know, so whatever they have to do to keep you interested is fine. I'm not one who's looking at every little detail and trying to figure out what, you know, what there is about it to complain about, you know.
Yeah. Now, when after your first two movies, a year after two came number three, did they give you any indication they were going to do a time jump and you wouldn't be coming on to the next movie? Or was that like a shock when you were your character was recasted?
It was a surprise to me. I mean, I expected for a while that I was going to be in the third one. I remember when I found out that I wasn't, I was definitely disappointed. But, you know, it all worked out well in the end. But at the time, I was expecting to be in it. Yeah.
So, go ahead, Mike.
Now, what made you, with you having like a large break, 93 to 08, you were acting and they kind of re-brought back the series. What made you want to come back to it? And on another note, what is your thoughts on like kind of the weird spot the series is in? Because I know you've been in the last two movies. They're doing a reboot. They're doing a TV series. It kind of convoluted what's happening in the Chucky universe, if you will.
Well, yeah, maybe thanks to the MGM thing. You know, I don't, not in a place to speak too much about that. But what I can say is that as far as coming back to the series, you know, I was in high school when Bride of Chucky came out, or I was just getting out of high school. I watched Seed of Chucky come and go, and I was happy to be, I wanted to be a part of it again, and I was thrilled to get that invitation from Don Mancini back into the story. So I was thrilled to do that, and thrilled to do Curse and Cult, and I loved the way Cult ended, and some of the rules that have changed and the new possibilities that we've opened up. In fact, we've opened up so many possibilities that a series where we can have, you know, 10 or 12 or 8 hours instead of 90 minutes to tell more of the story is very appealing to me. I think that's a fantastic idea, and I would love to be a part of that. And I think that's all we're really thinking about right now. This MGM thing, I don't understand rights all that well, but they had some rights over the Child's Play name and over the Chucky character, but not Charles Lee Ray, something like that. So this is the movie they're making is an artificial intelligence doll gone wrong. There is no Charles Lee Ray. So in a sense, it's not really Chucky, and it's certainly not Brad. So yeah, that's a movie, but that's not our thing. So,
right.
You know,
now let's talk outside of Child's Play. You, you have the AV Productions recording studio. What do you do with that?
Yeah, I've owned, operated, and ran a recording studio in Clearwater, Florida for the past 4 years. I've worked with over 250 artists, musicians, bands, solo artists, hip-hop guys, female vocalists, country singers, filmmakers. I've done some film scoring and audio editing and all kinds of work. I got a really, really great live room. And, you know, we run really good software and equipment. Yeah, we've done some really great work there. It's avproductionsonline.com. The studio's comfortable. It's a inspirational spot. It's really a great place to record, but a really good place to be creative and even start, you know, from putting some of my own creativity into the projects that I'm looking to work on. I've worked on a few things of my own through that studio, and I'm continuing to do that. The studio is still running. We're doing really good. I'm working with a bunch of people currently. It's been a lot of fun.
I know you've also done, you ran some poetry books, you've done some screenwriting. Yeah. Is there any area in particular you're looking to stick to, or do you kind of like doing a little of this and a little of that from now on?
Yeah, you know, I'm not the best businessman, but I'm a creative person. And creative people are drawn to whatever outlet they can be creative in. Writing is something I've done since I was very young, whether it's poetry or screenwriting or storytelling or anything like that. So I enjoy that a great deal. I would love to have a job as like a writer on a TV series or something like that.
Right.
I so far have not wanted to live in California. But maybe someday I will. Anything like that, I would always be interested in doing more of. And I've been hired to write screenplays, and I enjoy writing. One of the films that I wrote, we made a couple years ago in Florida. I'd like to do more of that, absolutely. Acting, I enjoy. I do not really enjoy auditioning. So if you know, if I didn't have much of an acting career for sake of not needing to audition, that's fine with me.
Right.
Because auditioning is just really a tough, tough life. An expensive one also. You know, a lot of people don't, especially if you're trying to do it up here. You live in North Jersey and you want to go on auditions in New York City professionally and full time. You have to take off of whatever side job you have to pay for gas and parking and tolls. So you're talking over $100 to audition. You know, it adds up. It's tough. So acting, as things come to me, I'm very happy to consider them because I do enjoy acting a lot. And writing, and I'd like to do some directing. And as far as the studio goes, I love music and I love working with music. So,
hopefully, really, podcasting
anywhere. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I got a lot of opinions, and some people on Facebook are sick of hearing them. So, I might need to try another outlet for that.
Well, that's great. And Alex, if any of our listeners want to get in contact with you or see what future projects you're working on, how can they keep up with you?
Yeah, Alex Vincent Online is where I put updates about my appearances and different things that I'm doing. And then AV Productions, which is Alex Vincent or audio video, because we do both. It's AV Productions Online at avproductionsonline.com or alexvincentonline.com. Pretty easy.
So, Alex, before you go, I was curious. Have you, with all the success of obviously the Child's Play thing, what has anybody ever had you like come up to you with like their own Chucky dolls and have you sign them, or any weird like Chucky artifacts and wanted your autograph? Like, there's a lot of real culty horror fans out there. You got to have some kind of weird story.
Well, I mean, I've been making appearances for 15 years at conventions all over the world. So
right.
I've signed a shitload of Chucky dolls and cool different items and stuff. I'm yet to meet anyone that, you know, says their doll came to life and can I please sign it for them?
That's your son, sir.
Nothing notable that comes out.
That's how the TV series starts.
Yeah. It's a good idea.
Alex, thanks so much for giving us a couple minutes here, and good luck with everything you got going on in the future.
I appreciate it, guys. Thanks so much.
So, I guess it's a pretty common fear, but fear of dolls is called pediophobia or pediophobia. I don't know which one it is. Okay. So, do you like dolls?
I don't mind them. If I'm in a room with them, I'm not like freaking out or anything like that. It's not a point of choice.
I was gonna say, I'm looking over your right shoulder and there's two mice sitting there looking at you.
That would be Mickey and Minnie.
I don't really love those old China dolls. Those are kind of creepy to me. Okay.
Well, my mom had some like antique ones, so like every time like somebody would go past the room, they would throw a blanket on top of it because they would just have those. See, I tried at one time to find it so I can send it because I know we had some kind of similar conversation with this, but my mom has it packed up somewhere. If they move and I come across it, I'll definitely send it over to you because it's a creepy looking doll. But being in the house, and you know, I just got used to it. So.
Okay. So I wanted to dive into pediophobia real quick. Okay. So it comes from the Greek word padion, meaning little child. When we were kids, our parents often used dolls to amuse us. Dolls have long been a source of entertainment for children. Often kids talk to their dolls, give them names, groom them, play with them, and even share secrets with their imaginary friends. However, some are actually scared of dolls so much that they run away at the sight of these harmless toys. This is a psychological issue commonly referred to as pedophobia. Pedophobia. I don't know, pedophobia might be something different.
Those are a different group of people. People get weirded out by.
Yeah. So pediophobia refers to the hypothetical fear about dolls. Seeing a doll makes the phobic person believe that he is in some sort of danger, despite being safe. This phobia belongs to the class of automatophobia, fear of inanimate objects, puppets, wax figures, dolls, animatronics, that wrongly emulate the characteristics of living things. In pediophobia, the affected person might be scared of just one type of doll, such as the ones that can talk and walk, or a variety of dolls that include porcelain dolls and china dolls. Pedophobia is a childhood phobia, but if not treated, it can continue into adulthood. Quite a few adults with this phobia are even scared of kids. Okay. All right. So you want to hear some of the symptoms of pedophobia?
Why not?
Okay. The sight of a doll can wreak havoc on the emotional well-being of people suffering from pedophobia. It is a distressing experience for these people. Commonly, these people might scream, cry, or run away on seeing a doll with the fear that it might harm them. The starry eyes of the doll give them goosebumps or an eerie feeling. Other symptoms that may occur in pedophobia patients on the sight of the doll include hyperventilation, sweating, dry mouth, nauseous feeling, increased heart rate, shivering. In rare cases, the sight of dolls can cause complete loss of a physical and emotion control among phobic people, which is an indication of a severe panic attack. Okay, so they think some of the causes are dramatic events in the past incidents that scared the individual and which is somehow related to dolls seems to be the most common reasons behind pedophobia. So each time the individual encounters a doll, it reminds them of a past traumatic event. Genetic factors such as heredity, brain chemistry, and tendency to think negatively about dolls may also contribute to the development of pedophobia. So they might be passing this down. Like your parents might have passed pedophobia down to you.
I never knew that could be a gene fear.
Yeah. So a psychological reason given to explain this irrational fear is that the phobic person believes that the non-living doll will become alive. It is this creepy thought, although nonsensical, that makes them worry and feel anxious. The phobic person is unsure whether the doll has life in it. He tends to perceive the doll as something living. This strange feeling might be responsible for creating a fear of dolls. Hollywood films, such as Child's Play, have depicted dolls in a negative light, might also be responsible for some considering dolls an object of fear.
Wow, they specifically addressed the film on that one. And they have a few of them out there. I know, like, Puppet Master, that was a big series for a while. Demented Toys was, like, also a little knockoff of that movie. But, I mean, that's just something that's never, like, crossed my mind on phobias. There's stuff I can go, ooh, that's a little eerie, but not be afraid of it. I don't even get, like, the minor parts of it.
So, treatments. So if you have this is how you guys can go about this out there, listeners.
Okay.
There's snake milk cured my patio.
You afraid of dolls? Take some Berlew snake milk. You'll solve your problems in no time.
I went from hating that doll to loving it after 1 gallon of snake milk treatment.
My doll's sleep in the bed with me. Thanks, snake milk.
My buddy used to not be my buddy, but now he's my buddy again, thanks to snake milk. So, you can get treated with cognitive behavioral therapy. CBT is a clinically proven way to treat various types of phobia. In this form of therapy, the patient is advised to change his thought pattern and focus more on positive thoughts. Stunning negative thoughts that link the fear of dolls can be helpful to manage this phobia. Okay. Relaxation, deep breathing, yoga and meditation, and progressive muscle relaxation can work wonders to alleviate the anxiety associated with pedophobia. Other techniques such as visualization, in which a phobic person visualizes a comforted scene or place, can help with the pedophobia. Okay. Then we, of course, have exposure therapy. That is, of course, when you slowly expose some of the dolls. Okay. However, upon repeated exposure to the object, the person might have better control over his uncomfortable feelings, which may help in reducing the fear of dolls.
Wasn't that a thing like on Maury where he'd bring people with weird phobias on and then somebody would come out with something and they would just like scream like a banshee and run out of the building?
Probably, yeah. And then there's, of course, psychotherapy. This can help identify your underlying cause. With regular counseling, you have better control over your feelings, moods, and behavior. Okay. And then finally, Burley, you can go as far as anti-anxiety medication to treat your fear of dolls.
Or meth.
And
now granted,
meth.
It could work in either direction if you get some bad meth. I gotta be honest. You might fear dolls more with some bad meth.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I'm not afraid of anything to that level either. We've talked before how I might be a little tryptophobic, which is fear of unpatterned holes and small holes. But I wouldn't call it a fear. I would call it like
uneasiness,
an uncomfortableness. Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's good to know that that's like a thing. Like people out there feel that, because I always thought it was weird, and I always wondered why I felt strange looking at certain things. But yeah, definitely not a fear. It's not like if you show me a picture of small holes, I'm running out the door.
Scott, you want to watch golf? No!
But Alex Vinson, everybody, Child's Play. All right, you know what, Berlo? We've talked to a lot of cool guests. We played a lot of fun games. You know, maybe we're going to eat – maybe we'll eat candy apples together. Just to really,
aww,
you know, maybe we'll record it and just you guys can hear the sounds of us chewing on candy apples at home. And, you know, it usually takes about a good 20 minutes. That should be a good episode right there.
Easily. Does that mean I got you back into the Halloween spirit, Scott?
I think so. You know, I think so. I think I'm ready to go to a Halloween party. I'm ready to dress up, ready to drink out of a punch bowl, or maybe cut some holes in my sheets. Go down to Charlottesville, get a tiki torch.
Scott, you might have a little too much Halloween spirit. Maybe dumb it down a little bit.
Oh. All right, cut holes in my sheets. But guys, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in to our Halloween extravaganza. You know, every year we try to put these together. Next big one like this will be the Christmas one, where we'll see if we can bring Mike Ciccoli back if he doesn't die of lung cancer. Berlo, anything to promote?
Let's just promote ourselves and all. We've been getting some great guests lately. I mean, our last few episodes have been amazing. We had Jay Flow. We had, tonight with Father Sebastian and Alex Vinson. Been getting some great guests here, and we got some in the bank coming up. So I would just say continue subscribing to Verbal Shenanigans on your favorite. Oh,
I don't want to.
I don't know how to end this episode if they don't subscribe to the show.
That's true.
But tell your friends, share it out. If you have any suggestions or comments, you know, we love doing bits and talking points or whatever. Join in with the podcast, Verbal Shenanigans. It's like a really good podcast, but different.
What he said. And I will just promote a show that is coming up on November 16th for anyone listening in Connecticut. In Connecticut, I am going to be hosting a New York versus Boston show. That's the theme of the show. There'll be a New York comic, and there will be a Boston comic. And I guess at the end they decide who they liked better and whatnot. But it's at a beautiful place called Bridge Street Live. And let me just get the town on that real quick. Bridge Street Live in Connecticut. That is in Collinsville, Connecticut. So if we had any listeners in Connecticut, come on out and hang out. I heard it's an absolutely beautiful venue. So I'm looking forward to playing that. So it's Bridge Street Live in Collinsville, Connecticut. So with that, guys, please subscribe, listen, share, all that fun stuff. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back, yo.
You just disappear, Scotty, on the video.
Spooky, scary skeletons and shivers down your spine. Shrieking skulls will shock your soul, seal your doom tonight. Spooky, scary skeletons speak with such a screech. You'll shake and shudder in surprise when you hear the